It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
We live in trying times. Times of fear. Of suppression. Of hate. We don't need more or better leaders. We need someone willing to fight. We need to stop asking them to give us our rights. They won't support us. They won't compromise. We need to stop expecting that our systems will somehow fix themselves. We need to actually take the reins of power from them. We need to challenge them at every level. We need to fix this. We don't need them anymore. We can do better. We got this.
All right, that was the voice of Bradley slash Chelsea Manning. Remember that Bradley was a soldier who betrayed his country by leaking thousands of documents to WikiLeaks and making them public and putting people's lives in danger. Then you know that President Obama commuted his sentence. And in the process of all of this, the original leak came as a result of Bradley's failed love relationship with another man. And because he was upset, that's what he said. Anyway, he leaked these memos. And then we find out, as Bradley is put in prison, that he wants to be a woman. And so the government, that's our tax dollars, paid for Bradley to become Chelsea. Then Chelsea was released as though he had done nothing because President Obama commuted the sentence. So then the next step is that now Bradley Chelsea Manning wants to run for Senate in Maryland. But the story here is how quickly this whole LGBT agenda, after the legalization of gay marriage, has begun to infuse itself in the bloodstream of America. And that's what we want to talk about today. We want to talk about what's happened after gay marriage was legalized, what's happening to us, what's happening to our nation. My next guest says that we are actually becoming Sodom. His name is Robert Oscar Lopez, Dr. Robert Oscar Lopez. He's an American academic. He's the author of at least two books, Wackos, Thugs, and Perverts, The Clintonian Decadence in Academia. And before that, a book called Japheth's Daughters, which is a compilation of the effects of gay parenting on children. And before I even let Bobby speak, let me just say that Bobby and I go back quite a long distance. I first heard of him when Dr. Mark Regnerus of University of Texas did a study on the effects of gay parenting on children. You may recall that. That was a long time ago. And among the people that he interviewed was this gentleman who was an English professor in California named Dr. Robert Oscar Lopez. And it was through Dr. Regnerus that I contacted Bobby, and he did his first interview with me on radio. And before I go any further, Bobby, good morning and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Sandy. It does seem like we've been on quite a journey together since 2012, but I always appreciate being able to talk to you.
Well, Bobby, it's interesting to me to think about that first interview we did. As far as I know, it was the first time you really spoken publicly, and you were reticent.
Yes, I was. I remember that was the first interview, that one and one with Rod Arquette in Utah.
So, and I also always never will forget how much love you had a lesbian mother. You talked about your background very guardedly at that time, but you talked about You emphasized repeatedly how much you loved your mother, and you did not want to have the interview become a time of degrading or hurting her in any way. You wanted to tell the truth apart from that, and I always respected you for that, Bobby. Probably gave you more credibility. So since that time, much has happened to you, and we're going to tell the story in reverse a little bit. But before we get back to your personal story, you are now at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary teaching. You became a Christian during this tumultuous time of your life, and that's, you know, changed your whole thinking about this and kind of brought you to, I think, would you agree, some sort of wholeness. You know, you're married and have a child. You have just one child now?
I have two kids. Yeah, my son was born in 2014, so I have two kids now. Definitely, I think I got a lot of clarity after this broke into the public sphere. I realized it started really just focusing specifically on gay parenting, and then I realized you can't really just attack one side of it. It's the full spiritual war that we're fighting. So I feel very much involved in it. I've been at this seminary since the summer of 2016, so it's going on 2 years now.
Well, I have to say that you are a marvelous addition to Southwestern Baptist Seminary and to the Southern Baptist Convention because of your experience. And Bobby, I learned a lot of things about you. Let me just say, you just wrote a series of articles sort of alluding to the fact that America is becoming Sodom. The first one that I've read was called Mapping the Swamp, Charting Sodom in 2018. And actually, in this article, Bobby, you tell more of your story than I knew. So let's at least touch on it a little bit more. Yes, you were raised by a lesbian mother, but you were told when you were a kid that you were destined to become, that you were gay, right?
Yes. Well, I had my first sexual experience at 13, and I remember very clearly at that time thinking that I was totally in charge of this. This is what I wanted, and it fit in with what everybody was saying around me, which was that this is who you are, this is who you're going to be. And it took a long time for me to look back and say that was actually abuse. That was totally inappropriate what happened. There were the two older teenagers who got me drunk. All of us were under the age of 18, but this is part of the problem that I'm struggling with in terms of the LGBT philosophy across America, is people get caught up on certain legal distinctions. So they say, well, that wasn't statutory rape, but actually it was abusive. And the problem is that if we're going out and teaching teenagers about sex, they're going to abuse each other, and there's really no legal recourse because they're all underaged. So I was really pulled into a trap that it took me a long time to figure out and to understand. So that was from the age of 13 until 28 when I fell in love with my wife. I had alluded to that in the very first articles that I wrote, but really as time went on, I realized that the real battle, or at least one of the major battles that I had to fight, was about this question of sexual orientation, not so much just the gay parenting, but also just the larger ideology that says that people's being, their essence, is identified by their sexual behavior, and that leaves a huge door open for people to be exploited and abused. I was systematically abused by people in the gay community for 15 years. And then after I came out of it, then you look at all of the things that they said about me, the blacklist that I was put on, the threats that I received, the vulgar profanity that people sent at me, the interference with my job. I lost tenure at California. All of that is just a continuation of the abuse. And I think that it's so thoroughly infused throughout society that people who aren't gay, people who don't even feel necessarily loyal to this agenda, are all part of it. They're all complicit in it. So that's, in my mind, the spirit of Sodom. It's back. We're right there where Abraham and Lot were, on the night that Sodom was destroyed, where the whole city, there's nobody, there's so few. I mean, in the Sodom story in the Bible, Abraham had bargained with God so that if there were just 10 good people who would stand up, Sodom would have been saved, and he couldn't find 10. He couldn't even find one, really, at the end when they were rushing out. I mean, his own wife looked back and turned into a pillar of salt, and then his two daughters basically molest him. So we're there where, for all these different reasons, I think people have different reasons for being complicit with this. But I look at my own life, and I say, how is it that all of these people around me managed to miss what was going on? they couldn't see the abuse that was going on. And then even after I had come forward and told my story, they still couldn't stand up and say, this is wrong, and we've got to stop it. And so that's where I'm at right now, and that was what I tried to do with that series, was I tried to look very thoroughly at the Sodom story in the Bible and to try to understand all of the points of insight that we can draw from it. And one of them is this idea that a society can become so thoroughly corrupted because of this sex act. Because the sex act is degrading, and so it all begins with a lie that people tell themselves that when they're doing this sex act to someone else, they're not hurting them, they're actually showing love. Or when they're letting someone else do it to them, that's not abuse, that's somehow you falling in love. And then that lie requires all of these other things for people to cover it up and to deflect attention from it and to justify and rationalize. And so that becomes bigger and bigger, and you become a totalitarian city just to protect this sex act that really no one is benefiting from. So it's a scary thing, but as I meditated on Sodom, I really found so much in the Bible that helped me to understand where we are today.
Well, I have to say, Bobby, that I feel, you know, you brought so much insight to the story of Sodom that I had certainly never thought of before. I've never meditated on it. You know, we just read it, we understand, well, we think we understand it. But part of the point that you have made just now generally, but let's make it specifically, is you said it wasn't just that Sodom, that everyone was gay or lesbian or transgender, whatever, fill in the blanks. It was that they were okay with it. They were supportive of it. They didn't criticize it. They thought it was fine. It was great. It was in their bloodstream. That was the great evil of Sodom. It wasn't that it existed. It was that everyone signed off on it. Is that what you found?
Yes, absolutely. It was the callousness. And Sodom appears many times throughout the Bible as a byword and as a reminder to people about it, because of all of the different sort of bloodlines that are separated from the chosen people in Genesis. You know, Jacob is chosen over Esau, and Isaac is chosen over Ishmael. The thing about Sodom is that the whole city was destroyed, so those people did not, they were not able to have a bloodline that continued down to the coming of Christ, so they were never given a chance to be redeemed. You know, so when their name comes up again and again, it's not like the Ammonites or the Moabites or the Edomites who are, they're still active in history. The Sodomites were completely erased. And so one of the things that I found was that the Ezekiel reference to Sodom is very intriguing, and it often gets misapplied by people, because Ezekiel talks about a time when Sodom would rise up again, and that God would do this in order to bring shame to Israel and Samaria, to tell Israel, basically, look, this evil city that you always criticize, you're just as bad as Sodom is, right? And the description that Ezekiel provides of what Sodom's sin was is that Sodom they had a lot of excess, and they were rich, and they were haughty, and they did not care about the poor in their city. So I've noticed that very often homosexuals try to bring up that reference, and they say the crime in Sodom in Genesis 19 was not homosexuality. It was that they were inhospitable, or that they were cruel to people, and they didn't help people. But what I have figured out is that that's all tied together, that homosexuality as a sin, in order for you to justify it, you have to basically blind yourself to how much damage it caused, and you become a generally callous person. That's why the pro-gay activists, as you know, Sandy, they are among the most difficult people to deal with, because
yes,
you can't really get through to them. And
Bobby,
and
hold on.
They cause so much harm to people, and they don't care. You know,
yes,
that's the thing.
Bobby, hold that thought, because when we come back, we'll start with that. By the way, at least his series is called Mapping the Swamp, the first part, Charting Sodom in 2018. We're going to put this on our Facebook page. You just have to read it. It will give you insights into what's happening in ways that you hadn't thought. We won't be able to talk about all of it during this time that we have together, but I just encourage you to read it and share it with others. We have become Sodom, says Bobby Lopez, Dr. Oscar Lopez. We'll be right back with more discussion after this.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
I'm a Christian, a patriotic American, and a free market, shrink the government conservative, who also happens to be gay. What I mean by that is my values define me, while my sexual orientation sometimes feels more like, well, a footnote. Literally, in fact. I came out as gay in a footnote in my book, End of Discussion.
That's Guy Benson, and you see Guy on Fox all the time, being a Fox News contributor, very bright. And I have to say, in the interest of full disclosure, I know Guy very, very well personally. He was my producer in Chicago for a number of years, it's before he came out. And so let's just say that was Guy's video for Prager University, in which he expands on how a gay Christian can be conservative in his views and embrace conservative policies. It has nothing to do with his sexual orientation. And the reason I played that is just to another example of how homosexuality and the embrace of homosexuality has gone down further, deeper in our culture. People seem to be eager to embrace the notion that it's just fine. There's no difference, that you can be Christian and gay. But I'll be quiet and ask Bobby Lopez, my guest, Professor Bobby Lopez. He's at Southwestern Baptist Seminary. Before that, Cal State University in Northridge as a English professor. And that's a whole other story, how Bobby actually got sort of run out of town because he became open about how he really thought about his own past as a gay man. He could not survive in that world. Bobby, thanks for joining us again. And I would love to know what your thoughts were on Guy Benson's statement.
Well, I watched the entire video, and it really points to the problems that I was addressing in the Sodom articles, because if I can encapsulate Guy's message, he's saying that what really draws him to the conservative movement is that he wants small government and low taxes, and he wants a strong military, and he wants people to basically leave him alone about the fact that if he does consummate something sexual with another man, he's going to be harming himself, he's going to be harming the other man, and this is just in physical terms. And then he really is doing great dishonor to God, because God did not design man for other men. God designed men and women for each other. And so if I can pull together everything that Guy was saying, this points precisely to the callousness that Ezekiel was talking about in Ezekiel 16, when he said the problem with Sodom was that she was too comfortable, she was too much at ease, and she didn't care about the needy in her city. She trampled the poor. And this is the problem if you have a conservative political philosophy without the demands for social purity. You become a very callous society. At the very least, a liberal gay person who believes in high taxes and welfare, I mean, we can criticize the way that the welfare system is run, but at least they're combining their skewed vision of sexuality with some sort of veneer of concern for the needy. But when you have a conservative who wants the low taxes, who wants all of the economic benefits for themselves that come with embracing small government philosophy, but then you're saying that in your own personal life, you're going to completely blind yourself to the negative impact of what you're doing. And it doesn't just hurt the other man that you are sodomizing. It hurts all of the people who care about you, all of the people who love you, and the people who love the other people that you're sleeping with. And so what ends up happening is people who are in this situation that Guy Benson is in, they're becoming increasingly selfish, and they're using a very distorted, incomplete view of the conservative ideology in order to justify what they're doing. And they're not better than liberal gays. This is not an area where you can say, oh, well, I'm just like all other conservatives, except I do this. It's actually extremely toxic to mix homosexuality with conservative economics. And the thing about it that really disturbs me is you see this pattern where once the person has got it in their head that this is what they want to do, and they're going to have their cake and eat it too, they want to be able to call themselves Christian and to call themselves conservative, and then they're still going to engage in this activity, they start needing to color all of their social relationships with this. And this is what I have found with gay people, no matter where they are on the political spectrum. Eventually, they start, whether they say they're going to do this or not, they start excluding people who don't agree with what they're doing sexually. They don't invite them in. They don't hire them. They don't interview them. They don't publish them. They don't associate with them. And so they start shutting those people out. They start alienating them the way that in Sodom, Lot was essentially being alienated by the men of Sodom, who surrounded Lot's house and said, "We know that you have two visitors inside the house. Send them out, or we're going to do bad things to you." It's a similar thing where you marshal the social connections against people who are criticizing you based on this sex act. And one of the things that disturbed me about Guy Benson's video was he thanked the left-wing gay activist for giving him the freedom to run around and be a homosexual. And that is so disrespectful to all of the people who are his allies on the conservative side who have had our careers ruined. What about all the people like me who were abused and dragged into the gay lifestyle and we got out and we are constantly being attacked, demonized, degraded? We can't get published in many places. Our jobs are thrown into disarray. Often people contact our family members. Why would he thank the activists who did that simply because they made it easier for him to go out and commit dangerous sex acts without being criticized for it? It's the callousness that Ezekiel was talking about. And I think that line from Ezekiel where he describes Sodom as a callous place that didn't care about the pain of others, that does not exonerate homosexuality in the Sodom story. It actually makes it worse because it shows us that the abomination of homosexuality goes hand in hand with a change in you emotionally and mentally, and you start to become very insensitive to people.
Bobby, in your article, Mapping the Swamp, you talk about that in more detail, about in fact, I'm going to ask you to flesh it out a little bit more, because you talk about when you were fully a part of the gay community, as you were experiencing it, eventually you saw in the gay community, you've already said this in a different way, but I'm just going to ask you to say it even more clearly. You saw the behaviors and the responses to needs and people that you say now is reflected in the broader culture. I think what you would call harshness or intolerance, or you describe it. You have the better words than I do.
Yeah, I think it's callousness. I mean, when I had cancer in 1998, I was rushed into the hospital in the Bronx, and they had to cut out a tumor, and they ran out of the anesthesia. They miscalculated the anesthesia, so it was an incredible level of pain I had never felt before. And, you know, the nurses didn't want to admit me to the hospital. I don't know why, so I was sort of forced to leave. I was hobbling hours after having my body cut open. My dad did come down and help me there. I got up to my apartment, and nobody who was gay would help me. And these are all people that I was friends with, that I had worked with, that I had gone to many parties with and everything. They just completely forgot that I existed. And that may seem shocking to you, but that was very common in the gay community. They're so distracted with their cruises and their parties and their dances and their festivals and everything that they really don't take care of other gay people. So that's the first thing. You know, a lot of the people in the 90s who were dying of AIDS, for instance, they had to go back to their families, or they had to rely upon their heterosexual friends, or they had to join a church and rely on the people from the church because they had so many physical needs that were arising because of the disease, and other gay people just didn't want to be bothered. And I think a lot of it is because the initial change in people is that you are conditioning yourself to look at an act which does harm and to not see the harm. You have to deaden yourself to the harm. And I think that's one of the reasons why the drug abuse rate and the addiction rate is also so high in this community. A lot of people, at least the men, they do the drugs to get through the sex. And so it's a very dark place.
Yeah. Well, so one of the broader points you're making, which I think a lot of people listening to us this morning need to hear, Bobby, is the danger of us becoming hardened, deadened, desensitized, so that we embrace what we shouldn't be embracing, even if we're not practicing it. You know, I have to say, when I was in Washington, D.C. as president of Concerned Women for America, This was following the Clinton administration. It was when George Bush was had just been elected in 2000. So Bill Clinton did a ton to advance the LGBT cause when he was president, including gays in the military or don't ask, don't tell, and other blatant things. Because that they, President and Mrs. Clinton were all about gay rights, and so they made a lot of changes. Okay, so President Bush is elected, and he comes into office, and many of us just assumed, we assumed that things would be different. And one of the first things that happened, maybe in my first year as president of CWA, was that the Justice Department was going to celebrate Gay Pride Month. Now, they may not sound like a big deal now, but it was a very big deal then. Are you kidding me? We just elected someone that we thought was going to stop all of this. And so I got on the phone with, let's just say, a very high-level person and was having a discussion about it, basically saying what I'm saying to you, Bobby, like, we did not elect George W. Bush to see this in the Justice Department. What's the matter with you guys? And this is what came out of my mouth. I just said, you have lost your sense of righteousness. You don't sense that this is wrong? Because as I was talking to a Christian who was in high, let's just say, a person of note, a person that could have done something about this and was signing off on it. And I just said, you have lost your sense of righteousness. You don't even get outraged. This is so wrong and you don't even care. You're just signing off on it. And Bobby, this is the danger where people who understand, oh, Christians, I'll pick on them, should understand biblically that this is a sin that's egregious, that God just does not tolerate. We are tolerating things we should not tolerate. And that's the point, I think, one of the points that you're trying to make. We become too tolerant.
Well, we've become distorted in our sympathies. Think of how Lot's wife looked back and turned into a pillar of salt. You know, we think that people are blameless because we sort of look at them as victims or as people who are weak or people who need our help. But the people that we're giving that sympathy to are actually harming lots of other people, and we're denying our sympathy to others. That's the distortion of Sodom. So in Genesis 13 and 14, you get an early picture of Sodom. They're involved in this rebellion against Chedorlaomer, this ruler, and they can't fight in the war because they're not good soldiers. So Abram has to go and save them. He does it because of Lot. His nephew has been taken prisoner along with other Sodomite prisoners. After Abram defeats the enemy and he liberates the Sodomites from slavery, the king of Sodom does not praise God, but instead he offers to pay Abram for his services. And you know what Abram tells him? Abram says, I don't want to take so much as a strap of a sandal because I don't want anyone to say that the king of Sodom made me rich. So what the Bible tells us is that this is very insidious. That in a case like that, where obviously you want to sympathize with the Sodomites because they were invaded and they were enslaved, but they were freed at that point. They were a free people who made their choices. They had chose to act in that unrighteous way. And so that's why when you go later to Genesis 19, it is so wrong that Lot's wife would look back upon the city with that kind of sympathy, because those were people who did not need your pity. They don't need your enabling. They needed to be held accountable, and they needed to be set right. They needed to be on a corrector, on a better course. And that's what happens with homosexuality, is that, if you bargain with it, if you negotiate with it at all, it starts to manipulate you, and you get dragged in. And this is not even, we're not talking about people who are homosexual and who are involved in the act of sodomy. We're talking about all of the other social people in those networks who get manipulated and who get dragged in. And I think part of the Sodom message is, you know, after a certain point, you're just as much to blame as they are. You don't get to say, oh, well, my son is gay, and, you know, he wasn't a good athlete, and, you know, he was such a nice boy, and now he's gay, and I just want to support him and love him, and I don't want people to be mean to him. At a certain point, you have to say, your son is 25 years old. He's an adult. It was your job to raise him, to make choices, and to be able to manage his life. This is a terrible thing that he's involved in. It hurts other people, and it hurts you. And if you continue to enable it, you are the guilty one. And in some ways, I almost feel like the heterosexual allies like these people in the Bush administration or the people at a place like Fox News or whatever who get they get into these compromises with this. I feel like they're even more to blame because they're not even involved with the harm directly. And so they really are hardening their hearts and turning away from it and refusing to see how harmful this is. And we don't have an excuse at this point, Sandy, because we had an AIDS epidemic. There were hundreds of thousands of people who wasted away and became former shells of who they were and who were buried and who died. And there were tons of children who died because of the AIDS epidemic. We don't have the excuse of saying, oh, well, I just, in my personal life, my neighbor, I like him so much. He's such a nice guy. Or, you know, my boss is gay. I don't want to lose my job. You know, all of those things are things that are... they're warned against in the Bible, because remember what Abram said, I don't want even a sandal strap from you.
Yes.
Because it won't let nobody say that you made me rich.
Yes, Bobby, I'm with you. And let me just add as a footnote, we actually were able to stop that gay pride celebration at the Justice Department because of that phone call. I don't say that as a boast. I just say that that's how God uses his people. And it isn't that we turn our wrath or our ire against gay neighbors or gay family members. It's just that we don't start being complicit with their behavior and telling them that it's okay. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Well, it's one of those things that's almost difficult to know what precisely got everyone angry.
Yes.
Because most people concede the point that transgender rights can undermine parental rights. And so the general trope has been that I've said misogynist and transphobe and homophobic things in the article. I mean, it's difficult to imagine what the family could look like if there weren't parental rights and parental authority that parents would have to raise their children the way they see fit. I'm not sure that anyone ever read my article, and I've been proud of my administration for always defending my right to write on what I would like and my academic freedom. But
right.
At the same time, they've said that I've engaged in hate speech and that I've created an unsafe environment, and I've been uncivil. And I think that we're beginning to see at Boise State the conflict between a university that's committed to social justice and a university that's committed to rational inquiry. And that, to me, is the slow death of the modern university. I think the incivility that they see is that I don't affirm everyone's identity when I conduct my research on what the effects of identity politics are on the family. So I think that's the new definition of civility. It's you have to affirm people in their identity in order to be civil. Whereas the old understanding of civility, which I think fits with a university that's dedicated to rational inquiry, is you can agree to disagree politely with someone. I think what diversity means is the need to affirm everyone in their own identity as they understand it. And the failure to do that makes you uncivil or maybe a person who perpetrates hate speech. Boise State, for instance, has recently hired a diversity inclusion officer, and he is one of the primary people behind denouncing me in public. You know, he's blamed my articles for Charlottesville and genocide and called me a neo-Nazi. But what the effect of that is to make people without tenure and without the protections that come with an academic job less likely to speak, less likely to engage in ideas. And that's the diversity officer at the university.
That's the voice of Scott Ginner, who's a political science professor at Boise State. He wrote a piece about transgenderism, and then the university started trying to tie him to white supremacists at Charlottesville. I think my guest Bobby Lopez could relate to that, because Bobby was a professor at Cal State University when he started speaking out about what it was like to be the son of a lesbian mom and the effects of lesbian parenting on children, and then further that he had been a gay man now married with children, and he started being honest and writing, and he paid a very dear price for that. He's written a book called Wackos, Thugs, and Perverts, Clintonian Decadence in Academia, in which he tracks what's happening in higher education. It is the place where our kids, it's the training ground for them to come out into culture and take us further on this course towards Sodom. Bobby, you could probably relate to that story by Professor Yenner, couldn't you?
Yes, I could, and I would actually amp it up a little bit. He says it's the slow death of the university. I think it's the rapid death. The universities right now are collapsing in every way possible. Financially, there's going to be a disaster because of the student loan debt, and the waste of the financial resources is a direct outgrowth of the corruption internally, because it's not just that they excluded a political perspective. They basically created a network of friends who were self-dealing, and so they gave their own people that they mentored all the promotions and the publishing, and they blacklisted everyone who wasn't part of their social set. And so what ended up happening is you had one political viewpoint that was predominating, and nobody was really there criticizing them or challenging them about how they were spending the money. And so they wasted all of this money, and now the tuitions are extremely high. There's something around $1.3 trillion of student debt hanging over the people in the United States, and you have 40% of the adult population now getting a college degree. They're being routed through English 101 programs in all of these universities. And if you look at the textbooks for English 101, they're basically ideological brainwashing texts. It's very scary. I was going through some of these textbooks. And so, for instance, for the freshman writing course, you'll be given 9 examples of bad arguments, and every single example is a conservative argument. And then they'll give you 5 examples of good arguments, and every single one of those is a good argument. So it's really just collapsed. It's making people psychologically distorted, and I think a lot of them are graduating very insecure because people are graduating with huge amounts of debt, having studied a curriculum that does not prepare them for a job. It doesn't prepare them for being a good citizen. It doesn't lead them closer to happiness. And so they're reaching out and trying to establish their status through other means, by these crazy protests, by getting caught up in political movements, by becoming kind of rude and sarcastic. So our whole culture is falling apart for it. It's really a comprehensive collapse of a major part of our economy.
But Bobby, you know, we could talk a lot about, and you do, and we should, about what's happening in colleges and universities. I don't think you have to convince many people anymore that it has become a disaster, right, having watched the riots, you know, in Berkeley and all the other places. But what is... Okay, we've talked today about the influence of the radical homosexual movement, LGBT, whatever, you fill in the blanks about what kind of movement it is. How about that? I mean, how does that intersect with all of this, that movement?
Well, the universities grew out of the medieval monastic cloisters. They were originally basically monastic orders or cloisters of holy men, and it was a very sex-segregated community because in the medieval age, of course, all of them made very strong professions to believe in God. They took the oaths of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and they didn't get married or they didn't have any relationships with women. And so I think there is something in the academy that is has always been somewhat sexually skewed, because it was really focused on a priesthood that was very gender specific and that was removed from the normal course of courtship and marriage that everybody else had. What happened is that once the universities rebelled against the religious part of their mission and they became fully secular and then even anti-religious, you basically have a system that is given to that kind of sexual bizarreness. But now it is not kept in check by a sense of chastity or a sense of morality. So it was an ideal place, I think, for a movement to take hold like queer theory, which really exploded in the early 1990s and came to dominate virtually every field that it got involved in. Because the way that the academy functions is that it's self-regulating. People who are in the system and who have tenure get to choose who else gets PhDs and who else gets promoted, who else gets published. And so if you have a network of people who have sex with each other, who are gay, who have a chip on their shoulder about sexual issues, they're basically going to be making all of their decisions in terms of what gets taught, who gets hired, what gets published, what gets released to the public, how much money you're going to charge. All of that's going to be affected by their general outlook, which is one of being a sexual outsider, of someone who knows that their sex life is a little bit strange and who's very defensive about it. So I think that really did create a system where queer theory became a dominant heuristic in many fields where it was really irrelevant. And that's how the medical field, for instance, became totally distorted. you know, because there were all these people who were very devoted to the homosexual movement who were at the head of biology departments and, you know, clinical medicine departments, and they started to color the research, and they wouldn't publish things that went against their own sex life. They basically, they tore down the boundary that should exist between your personal life and your scholarly life.
You know, that reminds me, I was just trying to think of his name. I interviewed the doctor, I bet you know his name, the American Psychological Association back in the 80s. As you know, I think maybe the late 70s, or at least the 80s, had a sort of a, they had a conference where the gay rights activists intimidated and pretty much overran and sort of like created quite a disturbance in an effort to change the classification of homosexuality as a mental disorder. And I interviewed Dr. Spitzer, I think his name was Spitzer, Robert.
Yeah, Leo Spitzer, I think that's his name.
Okay, so I interviewed him while I was in radio in Chicago, a long time before I met you, Bobby. And he told me about it. He told me what was happening. And he, of course, was a secular atheist Jew. He had no idea where I was coming from, but he was very honest about his experience. And then what happened when he started seeing people that had come out of the gay lifestyle and had, like you, Bobby, he met some Bobbies who had become, decided they really were wired to love women, that God had made them, not all of them were Christians, but many of them were, and that they had gone on to marry and have fruitful lives. And he'd done a lot of interviews and psychological evaluations, and he came out and wrote about that. So then the gay radical leftists came after him with a vengeance. And that's when I spoke to him on the radio. He was going through what probably you've gone through, but it was all new. And he actually changed his mind again. My point is that the gay activists actually strong-armed that change in the medical journals. It wasn't that it just happened organically or that suddenly doctors decided and discovered by observation that there was nothing wrong, nothing disordered about homosexuality.
Right. It was manipulated and it was under duress. And it really reflects the fact that this sex act, when it takes root in your life, you become, you change mentally. You can't accept any sort of input or any statements by other people that is going to draw your attention to something that you're doing that is really contrary to your nature and contrary to the way that your body is designed. And so you're in a constant state of disavowal and denial, and it starts, the circle of people that you have to rope into this gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and the tactics that you have to use to keep this going start to become more and more aggressive. And definitely within the academy, that was a problem, because there was definitely a circle of people who were engaged in this is largely male at the beginning. They were involved in a lot of sex networks of men having sex with men. University libraries were often very common places where young people like myself were initiated into gay sex, because there were older men hanging around universities who would have sex with you in library bathrooms or things like that. I know it sounds disgusting, but this is the reality of what was going on throughout the 70s and 1980s. And so you ended up having this network of people who, they did each other favors, they protected each other, they had a kind of us versus them mentality where they felt like they had to protect their community and their networks from being attacked, particularly from Christians. So they had this very anti-religious bias, and they started to become more and more aggressive about stamping out anybody who would dissent from them. And this is one of the reasons why I find it so disturbing that people still think of gays as victims or as people who need a protected status. I mean, it's been a very long time, Sandy, since I walked into a church and ever heard someone from the pulpit say anything about homosexuality that was negative. You know, it's the time period when they were embattled and embittered and beaten down and victimized, that is so far in the past. And yet they're still clinging to that, and people are not seeing how abusive this movement is, and how a really important institution like American medicine, and I just did a bunch of interviews with Paul Church, for instance, who lost his positions in Harvard Medical School. You know, this is serious harm that they're doing. They're skewing the research, they're corrupting the data, and so that has a multiplier effect, because now everybody is looking at information that's not valid when they're determining treatments for people. And so people are going out and they're infecting other people, or they're harming themselves emotionally or physically because this sex act is bad. There's no way to put it, you know, there's no way around it. You know, it's not a good thing to do. And even if you're not going off of the Bible, you know, in Romans 1, Paul says, everything was made clear from the creation of the world. You know, the way that God created us reveals his design for us. And this really goes against what God designed us for.
Bobby, we just have a few minutes left. And so let's talk very briefly now. We just have a few minutes about what churches should be doing. You're seeing, you are watching, and so am I. You've just alluded to it. The loss of, as I said earlier, righteousness, a sense of unrighteousness among pastors and churches about this issue. What should they be doing? You just have 1 minute.
I think the churches have to follow the lead of Abram in Genesis 14, and they say, we're not going to take a single strap of a sandal from the movement. I think you have to reach out to the people who are in the lifestyle, the average, everyday person who's toying with identifying as gay. Those people deserve your compassion and your help. The organizations that are well-funded and powerful do not, because those are people who are in power, and they're generally abusive, and they're trying to lead you down a path that's bad.
All right, the book is called, one of the books, Wackos, Thugs, and Perverts. We'll put a link to that, but I also want you to read Bobby's article. It's a different, but it's so intriguing, Mapping the Swamp, Charting Sodom in 2018. Robert Oscar Lopez, Dr. Robert Oscar Lopez. Bobby, thank you for joining us this morning. Thank you so much.
Thank you
Sandy,
so much.
Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.